Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello and welcome to The Shift, the podcast that aims to tell the no-holds-barred truth about being a woman post 40. Created and hosted by me, writer and broadcaster Sam Baker. I'm delighted to welcome back my good friend Jojo Moyes. As I'm pretty sure you already know, Jojo is the global best-selling author of Me Before You and 16 other novels. She's sold 51 million copies globally, and several of her books have been turned into hit movies, including Me Before You, for which she wrote the screenplay. Her latest, Someone Else's Shoes, will definitely be joining them. It's an action-packed, emotionally astute, laugh-out-loud look at what happens when two very different women accidentally pick up each other's gym bags. It tells the good, the bad, and the ugly about middle age. It's a love letter to female friendship and an ode to the totemic power of shoes.
Sometimes I feel very strong and think I genuinely don't care what anybody thinks of me. And that does come with age. That's definitely become more pronounced as I've gone into my 50s. But there is always going to be a bit of me that feels anxious and wants people to like me or thinks that I look nice. And I think, you know, that's probably the standard female experience.
I met with Jojo for a very long overdue catch-up. We talked the liberation of being in our 50s, growing into your looks in middle age, and surviving the midlife maelstrom of divorce, kids leaving home, perimenopause, and workaholism. Oh, and guess what? She's a secret petrolhead. Who knew? Because we haven't seen each other for so long. I want to say thank you so much for being, for massively taking a punt on The Shift before it even existed.
Oh my God, don't be ridiculous. No, I mean, I think you've helped open up the whole conversation about women of a certain age, and that's got to be a healthy thing. So yeah, well done you.
Oh, when I was reading it, I was thinking, I cannot imagine this book having been written, not because of The Shift, but even like certainly 10 years ago. Oh my God, how long ago? 10 years ago when I started to go through the menopause, but didn't know that was what was happening. But even five, really, because when we were trying to sell The Shift to publishers, when was that, 2019? They were all a bit like, nah, no one's interested. There were, you know, very few books with lead female characters. And you've basically written an amazing ensemble movie for loads of female actresses over 40.
Yeah. Because actually, I think there's a definite recognition creeping in now that women of a certain age still have some value. We have things to say. We have experiences. We can be funny. We can be active. We can be sexual. We can be all those things. And I don't know, I find there is something so liberating about this age that I wanted to kind of get out onto a page.
Has that changed since we last spoke? Because when did we, I can't remember when we did the interview for the last one. It was pre-pandemic. Yes. And I remember I was waiting outside your flat and you turned up at your flat carrying this enormous like 100-tog duvet. And I was like, oh, she's not perimenopausal because there's no way that a duvet would get through the front door if she was having night sweats.
No, maybe I was and didn't know it, because what I didn't feel ready to talk about in that podcast was my own struggles. And I've thought about that a lot since, because I think psychologically I have emerged in a very different place to when I last saw you. Like many people, I had a very tough few years, not just in terms of the pandemic, although that was, you know, harrowing for everybody in their own way. Everybody went through something. But I also ended my marriage of 22 years. My mother died after a long battle with cancer. I won't say I completely fell apart, but I certainly became very frayed at the edges due to my own workaholism, I think. Mm. And I've had to do the work to understand what happened and how not to let that happen to me again. So I went on antidepressants for a couple of years, which were an amazing help, and I'm still in therapy. But there was a lot to deal with, which completely shifted my whole life and the way I look at the world. So yeah, I feel like I'm probably quite a different person from the person who did that last podcast with you. Although I still do like a really warm duvet.
I think it's so interesting because a lot of those things often happen at the same time. And it's partly, you know, we're at an age where things start to happen to our parents, of course.
Yep.
But depending on how old your parents were when they had you and all of that. But also, I think that list of stuff that you just reeled off, you know, like losing a parent, divorce or separation, therapy, like
kids leaving home. I didn't
kids leaving home.
Yeah.
Reevaluation of the way you've been like living your life and structuring your life, whether it's like a whether it's a relationship or work. The number of people I speak to who make really big changes to that around 50, and quite often, like you didn't mention menopause, and I don't really like the kind of, oh, menopause is to blame for everything. But I do think that somewhere in there is that menopause is a factor and is part of the puzzle that makes all those things happen.
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely, I haven't been through it yet. I wish I bloody had been, because I'm
still
so
have
bored
periods?
Of periods. Yeah.
Oh my God, nightmare.
Yeah, I'm 53.
Oh, Jesus. I haven't had a period since 47.
Oh my God, the joy. But I'm definitely perimenopausal and I'm on HRT and I'm a massive, massive believer in it. I went on it because I did that thing of going into a supermarket and having no idea why I'd come in there or what I was doing. Mm-hmm. And it was terrifying. It was absolutely terrifying because the one thing I've held on to my whole life is a real clarity of thought. I'm a very sharp and rapid thinker, and suddenly that was ebbing away.
It's your job, and apart from anything else.
Yeah, it's my job. And my moods were fluctuating in a way that I couldn't understand because they didn't seem to relate to what was going on in my life. And yeah, I had night sweats. That was pretty unpleasant. I think until you have one, nobody can prepare you for actually waking up soaked, like soaked,
drenched.
Like you have to change all your bedding. So I was probably quite an early adopter of HRT, bioidentical hormones, you know, the safest kind. And all those things stopped almost immediately. So I figure that all the other stuff to do with periods, I can live with that. As long as I have a fairly level mood and my thoughts are clear and I feel reasonably cheerful. And also I had a bone density scan done 6 months ago. And thank you, weight training, for the past 10, 15 years, yes, because apparently I have the bone density of a 30-year-old, which was about
brilliant.
The only nice news I've ever had about my health. But yeah, so women, do some weights because it really does make a difference.
Weights are so important, aren't they? And I think it's just a thing. Mm. Well, like boxing, which I want to ask you about, they're just things that women, I don't want to say women are not encouraged to do, because I do think that's changing, but there is a kind of a macho culture around it. And also the kind of, you know, I mean, hands up, quite often when I have done exercise, it's because I want to be thin. It's only in the last kind of 5, 6, 7 years that exercise has become for me about being strong and flexible. So I think that because there's this myth that weights bulk you up, that women shy away from it.
Do you know, I've always been the opposite. I grew up in a very male environment. My dad ran a transport company. Sorry, I'm just looking at your cat in a bookshelf. Yeah, my dad ran a transport company and one of my earliest jobs was cleaning there. So I kind of grew up around lorry drivers and people involved in transport logistics. I then went into journalism, which was a very male environment. And I was a tiny, weedy kid. So for me, my focus has always been on strength and trying to be as strong as other people, or at least convey the impression of strength, because I was so tiny. And so I, perhaps less than other women, I think I've focused less on weight than how I feel. And I didn't realize how useful that was in terms of how I viewed myself until much later in life. And when I had my own daughter, once she hit about 12, I removed all magazines that made women self-examine their appearance from my house because I wanted her gaze to be outwards and I wanted it to be about strength and not how she felt about everybody else's gaze upon her. And I think in some ways that would be a losing battle now because of social media and the way girls especially are encouraged to put themselves out there to be judged, if you like, by other people. You know, do I get likes in this swimsuit? Do I get likes for how I look? I think it's so regressive in a lot of ways. I mean, we all fall prey to it to some extent, but I really feel strength and looking outwards is so much more important. And I try to convey that in my fiction as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting that 12 wasn't too late because, you know, I kind of watched my, I'm going to say it out loud, granddaughter. get much more conscious about that the minute she starts school. The kind of fat thing, which she absolutely isn't, started the minute 7, 6.
Wow. Well, my daughter went to a state school in her formative years. And interestingly, she went to a private sixth form college. And I don't want to kind of say anything that's going to get me in trouble, but there was a much, much higher proportion of eating disorders in the private girls only school than there was in her mixed state school, which I found really interesting. The girls at her state school were much more focused on kind of strength. It was really interesting. And I don't know whether it's a girl-only environment that helps foster that. I don't know.
Yeah, it's kind of horrifying. I think, I mean, it's one of the things, I think we talked about it before, and it feels really evident in someone else's shoes, that kind of, what you just touched on then, that objectification, if you like, the being the object of other people's gaze rather than the subject of your own life. And I think that one of the things about being this age that I really like is that, not that I ever was a person who got, you know, who got a lot of male attention anyway, but I think that I love that. I love the absence of that. And I'm doing this thing that I do every time where I've written things down that you wrote that I absolutely loved and then I can never bloody find them. Oh yeah, the brilliant, when Sam, and that's the other thing, it's like calling that character Sam, it was so weird for me. It's like,
oh my God, I didn't think of that, sorry, yeah.
The dismissive look of a man who thinks she's somewhere she doesn't really belong, the blank stare that disregards a woman no longer considered sexually desirable. I just thought, oh my God,
you know, it's a shock when that first happens to you. You know, I remember it very clearly. I remember going to a friend's dinner in a restaurant full of kind of young, handsome Italian waiters. And I remember joking with one of them and having the sudden realization that this guy wasn't flirting with me. He was being kind to me in the way that you might your mum.
Yes.
And that was about 10 years ago. And it was so interesting because until then, I think I hadn't felt that. And then that was the first time I felt it. And, you know, if you've been raised in a society that teaches you to value yourself through somebody else's gaze, it is quite sobering because you have to say, okay, who am I if I'm now invisible to a good proportion of the population? And for me, I think that has been alleviated to a huge degree by the fact that it coincided with my first proper career success. So I have had my sense of self validated by what I do rather than the loss of how I might have looked, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. I interviewed Dani Shapiro. We were talking about that because she's, you know, a tall, leggy stunner, effectively. But she was talking about being brought up, being told that's your currency, your looks are your currency. And then the moving into the, you know, good for your age bracket, which, you know, which is so,
see,
it's so weird,
like,
isn't
that.
It?
I think because I was not a spectacularly attractive teenager. I think I probably didn't look how I would have liked to look until I was in my late 40s.
Yeah.
I mean, I was too busy. And also in the early 90s, we weren't kind of encouraged to think about appearance in the same way. I think there was a lot of ladette culture and I was very much a jeans, boots, scrape your hair back, little bit of mascara type person. And I remember being kind of so astonished when nail bars started springing up around London because I think I can count the number of manicures I've had in my entire life on two hands. I'm just not a high maintenance person. And there's suddenly all these women putting hours into their appearance, like actual hours. And so, yeah, I think I kind of bypassed that And it was only really when I understood, when I got older, that the cut of your clothes or a good haircut could actually make the difference to how you felt in a fairly significant way. I don't think I felt the loss of my looks in the same way that somebody who was always encouraged to believe that they were beautiful and that was their currency. Also, my mum was someone who was incredibly low maintenance. She was, you know, I think till the day she died, it was a kind of lick of Nivea and, you know, a tiny bit of foundation for special occasions. And I'm sure you're affected by what you see your mother doing in terms of how much they look after themselves. Yeah,
not like massive groomers and
no,
and all of that. I mean, the quote that the publishers pulled out on the cover of someone else's shoes, I don't know if I've even said the title, so but make sure I say the title, just really, really struck a chord, is that people decide what they think you're capable of based on how you look, doubly so if you're a woman. If you're a woman of a certain age, that boils down to pretty much nothing.
Yeah.
And I think that will resonate with so many readers. But it is kind of the opposite of your experience, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think the fun that I had in this book was taking two women in their late middle years, you know, their late 40s, and making them polar opposites. Sam internalizes everything that happens to her and thinks that in some way she is lacking, in some way she's not working hard enough or trying hard enough or looking good enough. And Nisha, who has spent her whole life cultivating her appearance to gain power, suddenly has all that swept away from her, but she turns it outwards. She's angry at the world. She doesn't care what people think of her. She just cares about what she wants and how she gets it. And that was a really fun character to write, because I think that the two of them were extremes of how I view the world. You know, sometimes I feel very strong and think I genuinely don't care what anybody thinks of me. And that does come with age. That's definitely become more pronounced as I've gone into my 50s. But there is always going to be a bit of me that feels anxious and wants, you know, wants people to like me or thinks that I look nice. And I think, you know, that's probably the standard female experience. But yeah, with invisibility, you have to reassess who you are. And I mean, I do remember when I was in my early 20s, I had long blonde hair. I had a tiny flat in Hampstead that was my best friend's, and she let me live in it while she was working abroad. And I had a little red MG sports car. And I remember going on a date with a man who said, oh, you look like this kind of blonde, gorgeous thing, and you have this sports car and you have the little flat and you're a journalist. And it was like he was ticking things off a list. And I thought, I could be anybody. And I cut my hair off not long after. I cut it really short. And I remember really clearly noticing that the amount of attention I got was kind of halved immediately. But the attention I got was much more from the kind of men I wanted attention from, you know, men who were not going to be swayed by what they saw as sort of stereotypical attractive attributes. And I think there's probably still a bit of that in me. Like, I kind of don't care what most people think of me. I don't find other people attractive.
You know, exactly.
You know, the whole, exactly. I was married for 22 years and, you know, completely faithful. I'm just not somebody who needs validation in that way. But it's interesting, especially when you get to this age, the kind of people who might reach out to you, whether they're male or female, who find you attractive in any way, whether it's your character or your appearance, tend to be much more the kind of people you might be interested in having some kind of relationship with.
You write in all your books with incredible honesty about the trajectory of long-term relationships. And it's so interesting, because I remember when I was writing The Shift, and we've talked about this before, the number of women who were just like, oh my God, if I have to watch him, I don't know, eat whatever with his fingers one more time, I'm going to like punch something. And one woman said to me, you know, it's just that what we want is starting to go in different directions. And he is truly happy playing golf and picking up a Kung Pao chicken on the way home. And I just can't bear it if there's not more to life than golf and Kung Pao chicken.
I hear it from so many women. And it's interesting when you tell your friends that, you know, your marriage is ending, especially in your late 40s. Well, there's a number of responses. There's a lot of people who said to me, you know, you're mad, because security is everything. And even a lawyer who I went to see said, well, it's a good job you're this side of 50, because you still have time to maybe find somebody else. Like, I had this shelf life, and and it was kind of rapidly evaporating. And I just remember kind of being open-mouthed at the way he said it, like, yeah, okay, that's a nice thing to hear. But I can say the other response is from women who suddenly open up and reveal that, you know, maybe they haven't had sex for 10 years, or they're so miserable, but they can't leave because of finance, or they are just, yeah, exactly that. If they have to sit on their sofa beside their husband again, you know, they will literally go mad. And I think there is definitely a thing where men are happier with the status quo and women are free of their responsibilities suddenly, having spent maybe 20 years looking after children or elderly parents or whatever, and suddenly going, well, hang on, I might have 20, 30 good years left. What am I going to do with them? And, you know, my ex-husband is a lovely man and we still speak most days. We always have done. I'm very proud of the way we've managed to get through our divorce. And in fact, the lawyer who dealt with it sent me an email afterwards saying, I wish everybody treated each other with the kindness and dignity that you two have. Because our priority was harmony as far as possible and looking after our children and not presenting them with the kind of setup that was going to scar them for life. You know, I'm sure we'll have scarred them in some way, but hopefully, you know, we still spend every Christmas together. We always have done and always will. But at the same time, we wanted different things. And I just, you know, the pandemic and my mother dying made me realize that you do only get one shot at this wild and crazy life. And to some extent, you know, maybe it's a selfish act, which is a hard thing to contemplate because we're always brought up as women to kind of put other people's needs first. But I feel like everybody in my family, because I still do consider my ex-husband family, we've all come through it in as good a way as possible. And we will always be a family to some extent. People might not agree with that, but, you know, again, I don't care because I'm 53. And I know the truth of the situation. My kids and I have a very, very open relationship about feelings. That's one of the things that I've tried to give them that I probably didn't have growing up. We talk about uncomfortable stuff and we talk about difficult stuff, and we've all processed all the things, basically.
Do you think they find it easier to be open about stuff than you do?
Maybe not. One of the things I did, because I'm a massive believer in therapy, it has completely changed my life, and I've been in and out of it for 20 years, and it has given me so many tools for coping that I wouldn't have had otherwise. And so one of the things I did say to them when we told them what was happening was, if you want it, I think you should have some therapy, because it's important for you to be able to have ugly feelings and discuss them with someone who is not your family, so that you have a safe space to process all that stuff. And two of them have done that. One of them is going to. And I think my generation, our parents, shut everything down. I mean, unless you were very unusual, but our parents were not comfortable talking about feelings, not uncomfortable admitting to vulnerabilities or problems. That's a sweeping generalization, obviously.
Yeah.
But with a lot of people that I speak to, it seems to hold. And, you know, maybe there are some advantages to the stiff upper lip, but for me personally, I can't see many. So I was determined that my kids should be able to talk about things in an open way. And you know what? Sometimes it's really uncomfortable. It's not always easy to hear if someone thinks that you've been crap at something, but we're always respectful and we're always kind. And what I'm very proud of my kids for is that they can talk about what they need. And that was something I never, you know, it's taken me a lot of years of therapy to talk about what I need. And, you know, it's interesting just listening to the whole furore about Harry and talking about therapy, because even as I'm speaking, I'm aware that there is a certain level of seeming indulgence to it. The response to Harry is very interesting, because I think in families, there are often people who feel threatened if somebody announces they're in therapy. And with Harry, I believe that we see him as extended family, because we see the royals as a kind of extended British family. Mm. And so there are a lot of people feeling threatened by this apparent shift in his focus and behavior. And I'm a complete believer in good therapy and using tools. And I just don't think it's a sign of weakness. I think it's a sign of strength. And I just could not have got through a lot of the stuff that I've got through in the last few years without having a safe space to discuss and weep and get angry about stuff and understand my own crappy patterns of behavior as well. You know, we are really good at repeating things and not understanding why we're doing them and sabotaging our own happiness. And I just want to give me and my children the best chance of happiness that we can get in an extremely difficult world.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Sorry, that was a lot, wasn't it?
No, it's really interesting. And I was just thinking that it's so true, because I was totally dismissive of therapy and was not the kind of person who would have therapy, and was famously, like, you know, the health editor on Reddit. And before, the health editor would come in and suggest an idea and I'd go, too woo-woo, next,
yeah.
You know. And it was only when I finally had my own therapy at the same time as I was perimenopausal and, you know, that kind of confluence of events, that I realised the damage that I had done to, well, not, I say done to myself, but that had been done by, you know, keeping the lid on the box of things that happen when you're a bit younger, and how that influences you. Like, you talked about your workaholism, and I was a massive workaholic.
Yeah.
And even now, when I can't work the way I used to because of long COVID, I still find myself trying to work 12 hours a day, you know, and then wondering why I've got a bloody awful headache and have to take a day on the sofa, because I can't kick that. Although now I know that I'm doing it and I know why I did it. I was just constantly trying to not think, I suppose.
Yes, yes, that's it. It's an avoidance strategy. I mean, there's that fantastic book titled The Body Keeps the Score.
It's a fantastic book.
And what I realise now is the title enough alone resonates with me, because your body does keep the score. And sometime around late 2019, I started having panic attacks, which I'd never had in my life. And I'd always assumed that panic attacks were a thing where you just felt a bit kind of breathless and worried. And what I didn't realise is it actually feels like someone is dragging you down to the bowels of hell and that you might be dying. I mean, it's an extraordinary feeling. And the first time I had one, I thought, am I dying? I don't understand what's going on. And I had a friend who had been through many of them himself, and he talked me through it and how to come out the other side of it. But they kept happening. They happened on a book tour. It was my body warning me long before I realized myself that I couldn't sustain what I was doing. And because I loved my job, I really loved my job, I still do, I couldn't understand how that could be workaholism. Because if I loved it, then why would it be doing me damage? Sorry, this does feel quite self-indulgent, but I guess you want me to talk about myself.
Yeah, sorry.
I also understand, like a lot of writers, I am quite introverted. I'm so comfortable in my own company. And what I understand now is that if you are on 18 hours a day, for example, on a book tour with no days off except travel days, and even then you are on because you have to talk to drivers and, you know, people who are accompanying you, because you have to make small talk or else you're going to look like a dick, right? You have to be polite and nice to everybody. But that comes with a cost too, because if you are not an extrovert who gets their energy from other people, if you feel drained by constant conversation or constantly being on, then at some point that's going to catch up with you. And I didn't understand that about myself, because I do like parties and I do like meeting people. Yeah. But now when I look back, I can see, you know, I do love a party, but equally in the middle of it, you will find me hiding in the loo for half an hour while I just recharge. You know, I feel like Wally, you know, when he used to go outside and get the sun to kind of recharge.
Yes.
That's me in a dark corner.
Yeah.
I can't do on all the time. And I think that affected me in a visceral way that I didn't understand until actually quite recently.
Sure. I honestly think I've only worked that out in the last year, you know, that literally that is the difference between extroverts and introverts. introverts, that extroverts are filled up by people and introverts are emptied by them. And if you do enough of that, like you were, because that was happening to you at the absolute high of me before you, wasn't it?
When I kind of fell apart was after Giver of Stars. I did a 3.5 week tour across several countries, including time changes. I think I had one day off in the middle, and that was just so that I could wash my clothes. But at the end of it, I'm just going to be really open about this. I was in Frankfurt, having flown there from Denver 24 hours previously, and I was at a lunch, and I started to laugh at a joke, and then I started to cry, and then I couldn't stop crying. And I remember looking around at this table at all these lovely people, publishing people, who were there to kind of celebrate me, and I couldn't stop. And it was mortifying. And yeah, I think that was the point at which I realized, okay, this this is no longer normal behavior, and you need to fix this. And so my plan initially had been to take a year off work and just have a kind of gap year, if you like. And I was going to travel and hang out with my family more and just do things for pleasure. And then my mum started to die and the pandemic hit. So it was not the year of rest that I'd planned. But in a lot of ways, with hindsight, it was, I don't want to say useful, because that sounds wrong given what I was dealing with. But being forced to sit still and deal with my feelings and sit with my feelings and deal with what was going on was useful, because I think if I hadn't been to where I'd been, I would have just tried to work my way through them. I would have written and I would have traveled and I wouldn't have faced any of it head on. And what the pandemic forced me to do was face all of it head on, because it was just us in our tiny, you know, area of existence for a very long time.
And I think that when something like that happens because you won't listen to any of the other warning signs.
Yeah.
Because you've been ignoring everything else.
Exactly. And I think I grew up in, you know, there was no mental health issues in my family. There were no mental health issues. You know, everyone in my family is remarkably sturdy. And that's lovely in a lot of ways. But it meant that I didn't recognize what was going on when it happened to me. And yeah, I think also British people especially, we're just very good. I'm definitely a plower oner. You know,
Coper.
I just put my head down and get on with it. And, you know, working in journalism as well, newspaper journalism, you have to deliver the story. That's it, you know, because if you don't, there's going to be a blank page in the paper. So I think working in that industry from quite an early age inculcated me with an idea that the work comes first, always. You know, you miss weddings, you miss funerals, you miss everything. You just do the work. And also, you know, my formative years in work were in the 80s when work was everything. I think this generation are much more attuned to how they feel about things and whether it's good for them or not. So hopefully they won't make some of those mistakes. They'll make others.
So the other thing about someone else's shoes is it's a total, I suppose, love letter to the solidarity of women.
It really is.
To female friendship.
For me, I couldn't have got through the last 3.5 years without a very small group of girlfriends. I have the same best friend that I've had since I was 16. And even though we weren't in the same part of the country, we spoke pretty much every day. You know, there was a sort of running joke with us that we would speak and one of us would be weeping in a car in a lay-by. So our children didn't see us cry. And unlikely people as well. You know, I've got one girlfriend. Well, actually, I'll tell you who she is. She's the director of Me Before You. And just every few weeks, she'd just send me a text going, "You don't need to respond. I'm just thinking of you, hoping you're okay, and sending love." And what I realized from that was just there is such a value in just checking in and sending someone a text and also giving them the freedom not to respond. Because the other thing I found during that period, and still do to some extent, I have become almost incapable of responding to things quickly. I used to be an immediate returner of email and text. I considered it almost a point of pride, and I was almost offended when people didn't do the same to me.
Yeah.
Now it's not unusual for me to take a week to respond to something. My brain literally says, I can't do it. I just can't do it. My circle has shrunk, like a lot of people, and I trust that the people I am close to know that it's not personal. It's just that I respond to things on my own time now. A friend once described me at the height of my success as looking like a rabbit in headlights.
Yeah.
You know, I used to flinch when I had a phone call because I always felt like I had to answer everybody immediately. Do the thing, do the thing, do the thing. Yeah. And now I just can't. I just can't. And I'm not willing to do it either. And I have understood how fragile you can get from what you think is a position of strength. And I'm not willing to sacrifice any of the stability that I've won back by being at other people's beck and call immediately. I don't know if that sounds sort of terribly hard or selfish, but
no, not at all.
I do respond to everything. I just don't do it in the time frame that I used to do it. And I think that maybe our culture, my ex-husband describes email as somebody else's to-do list. And I think that was a really good way of looking at it. You know, so once you know that you're actually responding to somebody else's to-do list, it gives you the freedom to maybe not respond immediately.
I think there are two things, aren't there? One is that if basically an email or a phone call or a text make you tense up and your shoulders rise up to your ears and you kind of your heart starts to race, there's something wrong with that in the first instance. That's not like great, you know, not so much now, but certainly I've had years and years where my entire days can be lost because of one email that I couldn't let lie. I couldn't just
leave there.
It's not healthy.
I didn't have the downtime. Like I didn't used to do lunch.
Mm.
Somebody very wise once said to me, if you have children, you can only do one other thing well. And I really took that to heart. So I did work and I did kids. And that meant that I didn't lose touch with my friends, but my friends were pretty much tied up with my work life. Everybody was involved in the media or writing or whatever. I didn't take lunch breaks. I didn't go out very much because I didn't have time. And also I lived in a very isolated place, which meant that to go to a thing meant at least 2 hours travel each way. And it had some advantages. I loved being in the countryside. I loved all that. But now I don't start work at 5 or 7 anymore. I did that for years. And now I get up probably 7:30. I get up when my dogs wake me up. I take them for a long walk on Hampstead Heath at least 3 or 4 times a week. Usually meet my best friend and her dog on the heath and we'll walk for an hour and a half and we'll chat. And I'll stop for a coffee on the way back and then I'll start work. And the luxury, the absolute pleasure and luxury of being able to see my friend and talk to her and live in the same postcode as her is something that I don't think is ever going to get old, because I think one of the things the pandemic has taught us is there is such value in connection and those small moments every day that ground you and make you realize you're not on your own and your life does not necessarily revolve around somebody else's to-do list. And it just makes me happy. I've moved back to London after 23 years. And I was very nervous about it because it's a huge shift from the kind of life that I had been living. But so far, it feels wonderful. I mean, my God, I've cooked from scratch for 22 years. Now, Deliveroo is my best friend. And I'm probably completely overdoing it. But it feels like such a luxury to be able to order food in. I can't tell you if you've lived in the country for years and never been able to do that. All those things just feel revelatory to me. I live near a Jewish bakery, and just to be able to walk down and get a bagel in the morning is extraordinary. It's such a pleasure. And I've really learned to enjoy those small things in a way that I just didn't even register them before. I didn't register their absence and I didn't appreciate them. And now I really appreciate them.
Do you think that there's something about this time of life? You know, and I can't speak for men because I'm not one, but amongst women of our sort of age, that in a way, I don't know whether it's menopause plays a part or whether it's just that everybody's been through something that's kind of an equalizer, and that
yes,
you can meet someone and you can decide almost instantly whether or not you recognize them, whether or not they're going to be someone in your life.
In your 20s and 30s, there is an element of competitiveness. And I don't mean that in a kind of negative, you know, women fighting each other for a pole position. It's like you're looking at all these so-called markers of your success, whether it's career, whether it's getting married, whether it's having a child, getting a flat, all those things that you're told that you should want.
In your 20s. List, yeah.
And the slight panic that you might be being left behind and this kind of mythical so-called race, you know. But by the time you get to your 40s and 50s, everybody is a survivor of something. Everybody is a survivor of something. And what I love about this age is you meet another woman and within minutes you are onto the meat and bone and sinew of life. You are, you know, I went to a launch party at a couple of months back and ended up discussing children's mental health with someone I'd never met before. And then I went to a women's sort of dinner last Friday, the kind of thing I would never have allowed myself to go to before. I didn't know most of these women. I had the best time. It was just, yeah, it was just all real stuff. And everybody had been through something. And it means that there is a compassion and an instant empathy between women that I wouldn't have recognized in my 30s. But I find it incredibly consoling and incredibly comforting. And it feels like the connections you make are quite real because they're not based on anything. You're not trying to present anything. You're just going, oh my God, here I still am. How about you? How are you? You know, it's just, I love it. I really love it. And I feel like it makes every event that I go to an absolute pleasure because you're having real conversations. You're not presenting anything. You're just going, oh my God, yeah, what have we just been through?
Maybe female friendships, the importance of them becomes renewed at this time of life, almost a return to a kind of a teenage, I don't know.
Yeah, well, we definitely, I think we understand the value. I mean, for those of us who've had children, we've had our heads down for 20 years. When you have children, you have to make them your priority or else you're not doing it right. You know, you have to give up other things in order to help raise them. And the weird thing is, once they hit their teenage years, their needs become so much more complex and involved. It's not like you can leave them. You have to be present, even if you're just on the end of a phone, constantly. And then when they suddenly spread their wings and start, you know, checking up with people or going to university or whatever, other people are taking on a little bit of that. And it frees your energy and your emotional ability to involve yourself with other people's lives again in a way that it probably doesn't since you were a teenager or in your early 20s when you had those peculiar, intense friendships where you literally knew everything about each other. I'm not sure if you return to that, but I think after a long absence, for me personally, I really recognize the value and the mood boosting and the energy giving properties of female friendship in a way that I probably hadn't understood for a long time. I mean, I get teary about how grateful I am for my friendships. I get actually teary when I come away. I'm so, so grateful to those various women. You know, and you've been one of them in the past. It's like we've all just stood up for each other at times when we've had our individual crises. And if you're lucky enough to have long-term friendships, and I think because I was an only child for 20 years, I always understood how to be a good friend because I had to. You have to cultivate friendships if you don't have siblings. So most of my friendships span decades and different stages of life. And I think the one thing I wanted for my own kids was to have those sorts of friendships because I don't honestly know how people get through life without them. I don't understand how women get through life when they say, oh, I'm not really a woman's woman. I'm just like, what? How can you not be? Because we do have different frames of reference. And we do, I mean, I love my male friends too. Don't get me wrong. I just, you know, but it's a completely different energy. And it's, by the time you get to this age, it's a completely different bunch of stuff that you're generally dealing with. So I like my male friends for different reasons.
Right, before I ask you the questions I always ask at the end, which I know you've answered before, but I bet there'll be different answers.
They probably will.
Did you see the stuff about Madonna in the Mail?
No.
Oh my God. So, you know, just basically the usual thing, you know, why can't she behave in an appropriate way for her age? You know, so she's launching a greatest hits tour and the kind of coverage that they run about her basically not behaving appropriately, you could just not ever imagine them running about Mick Jagger. Do you think that those double standards are ever going to change?
Yes, I do, because I think women are not putting up with them in the same way. I mean, whenever I read a newspaper article that says things not to wear over 40, I immediately want to get online and buy a load of those things.
Yeah. Because silver miniskirt, here I come.
Have some judgmental kind of, you know, middle-aged guy with his belly busting over his trousers in some newspaper office somewhere dictating what I should or shouldn't do. And actually, I shouldn't say just men, because some of the women who write those things are the worst offenders. Who was that great American politician who said, you know, there's a special place in hell reserved for women who do not support other women?
Yeah.
I just don't understand it. Also, like, just get on with your own stuff. Don't worry about what everybody else is doing. You know, I look at Iris Apfel. She's kind of followed
her own thing. God, she's a hungerer, isn't she?
And I'm sure she was mocked mercilessly at various points for how she decided to dress, but it made her happy. And now it makes loads of us happy as well, because I look at, you know, old broads like that, and I use broads in the fondest sense. I very much hope to be an old broad. And I just think, how fantastic that you have the strength and confidence to do what makes you happy without fear of how anybody else thinks, you know, you should look. So I do think women are, I think we notice it more than we used to. I think we just went along with it before. And over the last 20 years, I think things have started to gradually change. Equally, I think there has never been a kind of more misogynistic pushback. You know, you look at the rise of people like Andrew Tate, and you think we have to be hypervigilant. We have to always be guarding our space, because there are going to be people, you know, dictating what young girls should be doing and how they should be behaving. So I just think, yeah, again, the joy of becoming middle-aged is that you just genuinely care less. And, you know, I have sort of mixed feelings about Madonna in a lot of ways. Sometimes I wish she would read a room. But equally, I absolutely adored her, you know, for years. I looked up to her massively when I was a young woman, because she was the first woman I ever saw who was sexual for her own pleasure. Or so it seemed to me, that she did what made her happy, and she presented herself in a way that made her feel good. And if everybody else got titillated, well, good for them. But it was actually about her own feelings about herself and her body. And I remember kind of going to see her in concert, and there was this, her body was a work of art. You know, she'd put the hours in. And I look at people like her and J-Lo, you know, still busting moves and looking absolutely astonishing. And I think, good luck to you. It makes you happy, and good luck to you. That's all that counts.
And like you say, they put the hours in. It's their job.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it is their job. Yeah. Would I like to look like J-Lo? I would give one of my arms to look like J-Lo.
Yeah, would you like to spend the hours in the gym that she does? Probably not.
No, I'm too lazy. Yeah. No. So, you know, if they're prepared to do it, good for them. I'm full of admiration.
Right. What is your emotional age?
Interesting. In my head, I think I'm 31, and it's always a shock when I see this slightly crepey person looking back at me. But I would say, like I said earlier, I think it took me till my late 40s to feel properly comfortable in my own skin. I think I actually looked better at 49 than I did at 29.
Yeah, yeah, interesting. Give us a book recommendation. So it can be something that's been super important to your whole life, or it can just be something good you read last week.
I'm nearly finished a book called Conversations in Love by Natasha Lunn, which is a nonfiction book about our relationship to the idea of love, whether it is sibling love, parental love, or romantic love. And it is absolutely fascinating. It speaks to lots of people, from, you know, psychotherapists such as Philippa Perry to Candice Carty-Williams to, I mean, just loads of women with very varied experiences. But I have found it incredibly thought-provoking and useful. I've bookmarked loads of things. Yeah, I love books that sort of teach you something about yourself.
What advice would you give younger women?
Look outwards. Just look outwards. Don't think about what the world thinks of you. Ask what you want from it. What do you like? What do you desire? What do you want? You know, just be interested, because it's a lot more comfortable than feeling the eyes of the world on you all the time. And interesting.
So who is your old, I'm going to change it for you, who's your old broad role model?
Oh, gosh. I'd love to have the kind of sass of Lauren Bacall. Like, there's a woman who looked amazing, incredibly talented, but absolutely knew her own mind and didn't suffer fools gladly. But equally, I was watching Audrey Hepburn last night and just thinking, what an example of grace, you know, the epitome of grace, and just feeling like it came from a genuine place of gratitude and humility within her, rather than some kind of actressy thing. But I mean, I feel like I'm always picking little bits from people and trying to utilize them for myself, from Bridget Riley to Vivian Westwood to, I mean, Chrissy Hynde. Just there's a so many fantastic women. But I guess the communal factor, if you like, would be women who've stopped caring what other people think about them and just got on with their stuff. That would be the thing that I would like to take away.
What's your superpower?
Parallel parking.
That's worth having.
I really love driving. I've been a kind of shameful petrol head since I was 17. For me, cars were freedom. Like growing up in Hackney, where it wasn't very safe in the 80s, a car for me meant that I could get around without being hassled and without being afraid. And it set up a long, unjustifiable love affair with cars. And I'm afraid when I got divorced, I went out and I bought myself a Porsche.
Oh my God, the dream.
It is embarrassing how much I love my car.
What's the Porsche?
It's a Carrera 911 GTS and it's black and it's like the car equivalent of Emma Peel and it's convertible and I love it an indecent amount.
Good for you. And lastly, how many fucks do you give?
There's probably only about two left on the shelf. One of them would be my kids and the other would be changing depending on any given day. But no, very few fucks left on the shelf.
That's brilliant. And that is different than what you said last time. I'm so fascinated when people come back how different their answers are. Things change, you know?
Things change. And I was a very private person before. And I felt acutely when I realized that my marriage was going to end that I didn't want my kids to be visible in that. And I didn't want to be visible. And I had a horror of people knowing what was going on in my life internally. But again, what I found coming through the other side is that there is a value in honesty. And so this year, when I've started talking, I've been really honest about my mental health struggles. I've been really honest about what's gone on in my life, because if everybody is struggling, and I think there is a huge proportion of people who are right now, then what is useful sometimes is for someone to say, I've been there, I've come out the other side. Mostly, I feel what you're feeling, and it would be wrong to portray something else.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for coming back to The Shift, Jojo.
Thank you for having me.
And nice headboard.
Oh, thank you very much. This bed is actually ridiculously high, and I'm quite short, and I got one of those super deep mattresses to go on it and a mattress topper. So I clamber into my bed like a kind of 3-year-old. It's ridiculous, but it's very comfy.
Thank you for listening. You can hear a new episode of The Shift each Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what you hear, please do rate, review and follow, because it really does help other people find us. And if you'd like to support The Shift further, please consider becoming a member of our community. Find out more at steady.media/The Shift.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.